We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at Uni Church on the campus of UNSW, which was attended primarily by undergraduate and postgraduate students who lived on campus or in the suburbs surrounding the university.
Well, we have tonight before us two chapters, a fairly long passage, but yet it's all of one theme, it's all of one subject, and so we're dealing with it in one unit. Made more difficult because it is apocalyptic literature. That is, between the centuries just prior to Christ and the end of the first century, there's a series of writings which we define as apocalyptic. Parts of the book of Daniel, Ezekiel, Zechariah, the book of Revelation. There's apocalyptic literature, and there's a few chapters like this one in Matthew's Gospel and Mark and Luke, you find them also. The character of apocalyptic literature is such that it deals frequently with the final judgment, the clash between the forces of good and evil in the last day and in the judgment time, using symbolic language such that it's difficult to understand, it's complex to understand as to what is being symbolised. What parts are to be taken as realistic language and description? What part is symbolic? And frequently one event is used, a real historical event, is used to symbolise another event. And so sometimes two things are being spoken about, sometimes three things are being spoken about in the same verse. And it gets fairly difficult to understand. And yet certain insights come by the juxtaposition of these different symbols, by the pointing to this event and saying it's like this one and that one, and making certain promises from them. It's as if I should speak to you of the Hiroshima of our future and say that there will be no survivors and give you a detailed description of the nuclear blast in Hiroshima in 1945. Now, what would I be talking about? I'd be talking about something that happened in 1945, but I'd also be talking about a vision for the future. And I'd also be talking about the end of the world, but am I really thinking the end of the world is going to be a nuclear end to the world, or is that part of the symbol that's not a relevant part? It's that kind of language. However, while it is complex and in some senses difficult for us to understand, we mustn't feel that it is hopeless to understand. We have before us a description in some part of the destruction of the temple. And in that is symbolised the destruction at the end of the world. And as Jesus' death, resurrection and ascension is related both to the destruction of the temple and to the end of the world, that also is being discussed. And each event is in some senses symbolic of the other event. Are we going to be left at the end of the night confused? I trust not, because the central message that runs through the two chapters is perfectly clear. Some points will be open for disagreement. Some points you may want to disagree with me about, but I'm sure are not open to disagreement, really. Some points are general and clear and everybody will agree with. Everybody who reads the passage, and they, you'll be relieved to know, are the important ones anyway. The areas over which we have disagreement, in the end, will not affect greatly the way in which we're to live. The areas that reflect the way in which we're going to live are all too clear in this passage. How I thought I'd deal with it tonight is to run through the two chapters very quickly, giving you an overview of them under that section in the outline general division of the chapters, and take each of the sections and paragraphs in turn, giving you a few comments about them, but then coming back to the one area of particular difficulty in interpretation, that is the verses 29 to 31. And how you interpret that will then affect how you interpret all the other sections around about them. So that seems to me the crux of interpretive difficulties, and I will share with you three alternatives and encourage you to believe the first, because it is the traditional, safe and sound one. Well, I myself don't believe it any longer. And then we'll move to what are the clear things that are the absolute clear conclusions that we should draw, which will be a very quick and easy section. Well then, let's go back to the division. It starts off at the end of chapter 23 with Jerusalem and Jesus bemoaning its rejection of him and the coming destruction of Jerusalem. As he leaves the temple, his disciples call into comment the size of the building in verse 1 of chapter 24 there, and chapter verse 2. And Jesus prophesies the destruction of the temple. Not a stone will be left on another. They then go across to the Mount of Olives, which is just across the valley from the temple and overlooks the temple. And the disciples ask the very natural question, when? When will it happen? But notice the question's very important because it actually sets the whole scene. When will it happen, verse 3, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? You see, the coming of Jesus, the destruction of the temple, and the end of the age are all linked in together. What are the signs? When will it happen? That then has set the scene for the next two chapters. It's all about those topics and their intertwining. Jesus then gives his answer, starting in verses 4 to 14, by talking about life before the end. The end of the temple, the end of his life, the end of the world. There are many signs, he says, but you will find many deceivers who will point to these signs quite wrongly and who will say, I am the Christ, or there he is. But they're deceivers. There'll be lots of signs like wars and rumours of wars. Nation rising against nation. There'll be earthquakes, there'll be famines, there'll be fires. There are all kinds of things that people could point to as signs. They will be there, but they are not signs of when it is to happen. They are just the character of the end times. That's what life will be like in the end times. Persecutions, gospel preaching will go on in the end times. And those who stick to the end will be saved. And all nations will hear of me. These are signs that the world is coming to an end, but they are not signs of when they are coming to an end. It's still happening today, of course. Verses 15 to 28 heightens the element of controversy and fighting. For it talks about a distress. Jesus calls it the distress. The great distress that is coming, the greatest distress that has ever been and ever will be. What is that? Well, they are given a sign. A sign when something is going to happen. When they see, standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation, then they know the distress is about to happen. And what they're to do is to flee. What is this abomination that causes desolation? Well, let the reader understand. To which everyone I've ever met would like to. It's a reference back to Daniel. It's referred to several times in Daniel. Daniel 9, Daniel 12, Daniel 11. All three refer to the abomination that causes desolation. And Daniel is about as easy to understand as Matthew 24. It has to do with the judgment time, it has to do with the striking of the Messiah, it has to do with the destruction of the temple, it has to do with the very things we're talking about here, but exactly what it is, well, let the reader understand. What is going to take place here, though, at this point, is something dreadful, so dreadful that you would hope not to be there. Pray that it doesn't happen in winter. And then it sounds like it's a localized problem, like the destruction of the temple, for example. Because you've got to flee. If it's the end of the world, well, where would you flee to? What the difference whether you're pregnant or not? Unless you're a man, of course. Then It really matters very little. It sounds like a localized thing, and false prophets, false Christs arise, and so on. And it's a dreadful thing, and it finishes up on verse 28 with a proverbial statement that where there are vultures, then there's a carcass. Where there's smoke, there's fire, and you will know it. It will be very public when it happens. It will be dreadful. Then verses 29 to 31, which, as I suggest to you, will be the linchpin on how you're going to interpret all of it. In verses 29 to 31, after the distress, immediately after the distress, the sun's darkened, the moon doesn't give its light, and the sign of the Son of Man appears, and all the nations of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds, and then he'll send out his angels. Now, what is this about? I'll deal with the interpretative possibilities in a few moments, but there are some things that really has not got to do much with the interpretive possibilities. They're straightforward. There are three Old Testament allusions here, and we need to grasp them. The first one is to Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. The Son of Man coming in the clouds. We refer to that often because the New Testament refers to it often. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 is the great scene of judgment when the one like the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days and is given authority to rule over all nations for all time. The second is to the darkening of the sun and the moon not giving its light. That occurs frequently in the Old Testament. There are some references given to you in your footnotes in Isaiah 13, verse 10 and Isaiah 34, verse 4. But you can also find it in Ezekiel 32, verse 7, and Joel chapter 2, verse 19, Joel 2, 28, and Joel 3, 15. What is it referring to? First glance, it sounds like the end of the world. It sounds like the dissolution of everything, stars falling from the sky, heavenly bodies shaken, etc. It sounds like the time when the whole creation is destroyed and a new world, a new heavens, a new earth built. However, when you look back into the Old Testament, you find that these things in the Old Testament are spoken of as happening in the days of Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Joel. That starts to give you a bit of a problem, because if they happened then, what are we doing here now? And then you find that Peter in Acts chapter 2 quotes this kind of phrase and says it's happening on the day of Pentecost. If it happened on the day of Pentecost, what are we doing here now? You see, this language is used frequently in the Old Testament, metaphorically, symbolically. It's a way of talking of the great day of judgment. It's not necessarily talking of what is going to physically take place. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it is not going to physically take place one day. I'm just saying it is normal symbolic language of judgment. Judgments that were quite localized if you read through some of those Old Testament references. That aren't dealing with the whole universe, they're just dealing with the destruction of Egypt. But the destruction of Egypt is such a massive thing that it is described in these kinds of symbols. The day that the sun went out, the moon didn't give its light, the whole earth was shaken, for the kingdom of Egypt fell. It's symbolic language. So be wary of therefore assuming it's going to be physical. The third allusion to the Old Testament here is in the phrase at the end of halfway through verse 30, all the nations of the earth will mourn. You don't perceive that one as clearly because it's not in footnote in the NIV, but it's actually a quotation from Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. Dear friends, tonight is going to be heavy, hard work as a sermon. Hang on, it's just going to be that way. It has to be if we're going to understand this passage. Keep taking notes, thinking about it. Zechariah 12:10. Now, what is worse, you see, that a couple of places tonight I'm going to have to tell you that the translation is wrong, and I hate telling you translations are wrong. One, because why would you believe me against the translators? And two, because I don't want to shake your confidence in your Bibles. Your English Bibles are perfectly good. They won't lead you into astray, into hell, or anything like that. However, at certain points, they're wrong. Here is one. At first place, you'll see why it's wrong, because it's such a small thing you wouldn't think it matters. The words here are not the nations of the earth, but the tribes of the land. Now, the word earth can equally be the word land. It's fairly synonymous in English too, isn't it? But when it's the land in the Bible, it's referring to Israel. And there's no reason why they shouldn't have picked it up as being the land of Israel here. Especially when it's quoting Zechariah, and when you check out Zechariah, it's undoubtedly Israel that he's talking about. But what is worse, and this is a really bad mistake that I cannot quite grasp hold of why the NIV's done it, the word nations is not the word nations. Back in verse 14, the word nations occur, and that's exactly the word nation, but the word down here is a completely different word. It's phuleia, which is usually translated clan or tribe, and not nation. It's not talking about the nations of the earth, it's talking about the clans of the land of Israel, the tribes of Israel. That's what it's talking about. And the easy way of checking it is to look back into Zechariah chapter 12, verses 10 and 14, and you'll see that's what it's talking about back in Zechariah 12. Why the New Testament translators of the NIV haven't grasped that, I am blowed if I can work out. Every commentary has. Everybody has got it, and other translations have got it. It just seems to have slipped the mind of the people who are translating this phrase there. It's talking about the tribes of the land of Israel. Now, the easiest way to check me on that, of course, is to read Zechariah 12 later on. What is Zechariah 12 about? Well, it's about a great time of warfare when all the nations will rage against Jerusalem. And when everything is destroyed except Jerusalem, and it only is just standing by the skin of its teeth, God will intervene, and at that point will protect them and will give them the victory so that everything is flattened except for Jerusalem, which stands up on a high hill. And then the tribes of Israel, the tribes of the land, will mourn for the one whom they pierced. It's a very strange phrase in Zechariah. All the stranger because it sounds as if it was God in Zechariah. And Jewish commentators, even to this day, have wondered who the one was that was pierced and why he is described as God. Christian commentators have had no trouble with this. We've long since worked out when God was pierced and why people would be mourning this one who was pierced in Jerusalem. It's got to do with Jesus and Easter. So it's always been simple for Christians, always been a difficult passage for Jews. Jesus says, at the time that the sign of the Son of Man becomes clear in the sky, the nation of Israel will mourn over the one that they pierced. It's going to be a difficult little section, isn't it? So far, I've given you the straightforward stuff. Let's press on. Verses 32 to 35 say that all this will happen in the generation of the apostles. Jesus is quite emphatic about this in verse 34, for example. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Then in verses 36 through to the end of chapter 25, verse 30, there's a long section about the whole nature of the unexpected judgment that will fall upon the world. Jesus' warning is that the Son of Man will come, and when he comes, it will be unexpected, it will be in judgment, a judgment that divides mankind, and therefore the great thump of all this section is, be prepared. Always, under all circumstances, whenever and wherever, be prepared, for you do not know when that divisive judgment of the Son of Man takes place. You have time to prepare for examinations. This is an examination that you have time to prepare for. You know what the questions are going to be. You know what the answers are going to be. There's only one thing you don't know, when it's going to happen. That is the crucial thing to know for most of you, because most of us don't prepare ever for an exam till the day before. However, this might be the day, or next year, or next century. In verses 36 to 44 of chapter 24, that's straightforwardly spelt out for you. But then, to back it up, there are three parables that make the same point. The parable of the servant in verses 45 to 51 of chapter 24 there. Then the parable of the 10 virgins, which I suppose is better known one, the 5 foolish and the 5 wise, caught unawares, you see, at the great time, at the great moment when it arrived. They weren't ready, they weren't prepared, and so were locked out. And the parable of the talents, from verse 14 to verse 30 of chapter 25. Again, a picture of unexpected judgment. Each was given their responsibility, but then suddenly the master returns and calls upon them to give account for themselves. And some succeed, some fail, and the thing is picked up in terms of judgment being cast out into hell. Now, for a little bit of light relief, before we go any further, let me just clarify a little matter on the subject of the parable of the talents, that in a sense has got nothing to do with the whole chapters. If you're a person who's already dropped out, this would be a time to drop in, but if you're a person who wants to hang on to what the whole two chapters are about, you might like to have a little kip. Because the word talent is also a translation problem for us. It is a Greek word. We haven't translated it. We've just taken the word talent and we've turned it into the English word talent. And we have a little problem. You see, the word talent in Greek was originally a unit of weight, which came to mean a monetary value, much like the English word pound, which I understand was originally a weight, and which came then to have a monetary value. And so in the end, the word pound, you used it frequently without any reference to weight at all, because you were just thinking of the paper that it was printed on with the Queen and the rest. Now, the word talent, then, is a word of money. It's exactly what it is. And we should translate it dollar. One was given so many dollars, another was given so many dollars, another was given so many dollars. However, for a strange reason that is, again, escapes my understanding, we have continued to call it a talent. And that has confused a lot of people. Because the word talent today in English means something completely different. The word talent now means aptitude, ability, gift, skill. And therefore we think that these people are given different skills, different abilities, different aptitudes. And each has to give account for his skill and aptitude. So serious is this misunderstanding that it has actually affected such a worthy publication as the Oxford Dictionary. When I got out my concise, short or whatever Oxford Dictionary, I read that the word talent has three meanings today. One, special aptitude, faculty or gift. Two, a person of talent. Three, such as a talent scout, etc. Three, an ancient weight and money of account among Assyrians, Greeks and Romans of varying value. Now that's clear. Matthew 25 is the third meaning of the word. But when you read your dictionary, it says, first meaning, special aptitude, faculty, gift for music, etc. See Matthew 25, 14 to 30. Someone would like to write a little journal article, they could, on the Oxford Concise Dictionary and their misunderstanding at that point. Because it's money is the meaning of the word. We should have a dollar here. Now, why do I go on about it? Because I enjoy going on about things that... No. Because I spent the effort looking it up? No. Because there's a serious problem that has come about with people's minds. Very serious problem. Because they've taken that dictionary meaning... thank you. Because they've taken that meaning, they actually think that because God has given me a gift, I am now responsible for developing and using it. And that the day of judgment, well, I will be held accountable on the basis of the way I've used my gifts and skills and abilities. If I've been given the brains to do such and such, then I should develop those. If I've been given music, then I should develop those. Now, that may or may not be true, but it's nothing to do with what this passage is about. And the terrible part is down verse 30, because look what happens to the person who doesn't develop their talent. Worthless servants thrown out where there'll be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. They're sent to hell because they didn't play cricket for Australia. They didn't develop their talent properly. They didn't use it to the full. We all know we need someone who would use their talents in the Australian cricket team. Now, that is an attitude that is very common and one of the rationalisations people have for devoting themselves to the development of their own particular skills and abilities comes out of this passage and this misuse of the word talent. The thing is about money, and it's about the judgment of God. And the judgment of God is not based on what you have done with your different skills and abilities and talents. The judgment of God is based upon what you have done with the Lord Jesus Christ. You must know that from elsewhere in the scriptures. It would be very surprising if your cricket skill or your musical accomplishments or your university degree would play any significance in your judgment. So you mustn't read it into this passage. It's a dreadful heresy. It's on the basis of Jesus. So then what does the talent refer to in this parable? That is a mistake, friend. mustn't read the parables looking for everything to relate to something else. It's not like that. It's a story. It's a story about judgment. And it's a story just taken out of normal life. There comes a day when you are held accountable. And it'll be unexpected and you don't know when it'll be. And when it happens, then you will give account of your life. If you must find the talent to mean something, it will mean the gospel of Jesus or the kingdom of God. But translate it dollar and you would never ask the question. Well now, for those who have gone to sleep, come back, and those who are now woken up and need another rest, go off again, as we go to the last section, when the Son of Man comes in 25 here, verse 31 through to 46, and the great judgment scene is described in terms of the sheep and the goats, a well-known and famous passage, which is also seriously misused, so you better wake up again. Here this one is used to call upon Christians to give to people in need. The refugees of the world, the starving millions in famines and war-torn countries. And you're told that inasmuch as you do it to the poor people in the Cambodian refugee camp, Thailand refugee camps, inasmuch as you do it to the people in Eritrea, inasmuch as you do it to the starving anybody, you're doing it to Jesus. And inasmuch as you refuse to contribute to those great worthy campaigns that raise money for those people, then you are refusing to do it to Jesus. And you will be held accountable on that last great day, for you are unwilling to give to Jesus. And you will be pardoned on that great day because of your generosity, because you gave to Jesus. Now hang on, friends. The heresy bell should be ringing in your heads at this point. Because now the basis of judgment is the basis of your generosity to people in need. See, people who do not even know Jesus certainly do not recognize him in the people in need, because that's the point of the story, isn't it? People who do not know Jesus, because they are generous to refugees, go to eternal life. Is that what the Bible teaches? Well, I know no other passage that even comes close to teaching that. If that's what this passage means, it is unique in all the pages of the Bible. The Bible says nothing like that. The basis of judgment's not on who's generous to whom. The basis of judgment is on what you do with Jesus. There's mercy and forgiveness found in Jesus. Well, then, what is this passage saying? Where is the problem here? The problem lies in verses 40 and 45. Not in the translation, but in the reading of it or the failure to read it. Inasmuch as you do this, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. See, there are those people who believe that God is the father of all mankind, and therefore all men are brothers, and therefore all men are the brothers of Jesus. The Bible doesn't teach that, though. The Bible teaches that God is the father of Christians, and all Christians are brothers and brothers of Jesus. That being so, who is verse 40 referring to? Eritrean refugees? No. It's referring to Christians. Inasmuch as you do it to the Christian, you are doing it to Christ. Why is he saying that? Well, he's already said the same back in chapter 18 and chapter 10, which of course you know all about because you've been in church of recent weeks. And in chapter 18 and chapter 10, Jesus says, inasmuch as people receive you, my disciples, the little ones, the least ones, the ones who are of no account, inasmuch as they give you a cup of cold water, because you come bearing my name, they do it to me. They will not lose their reward. As they receive you, so they receive me, says Jesus, because you are my disciples, my representatives, my people. You see, when a man comes to you and says, I am a Christian and I am in need, a man especially who comes saying, I am a Christian, preaching the gospel in the name of Jesus and I'm in need, if you say to him, oh, look, rack off, mate, I don't give a fig about you going around preaching the gospel of Jesus, what is your attitude to Jesus? It's obviously negative, isn't it? And if a person comes and says, look, I'm a Christian and I'm seeking to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and I do need help in this. And you say, oh, sure, I'd love to help someone who's doing that. What is your attitude to Jesus? As people receive the messengers of Jesus, so they are indicating their reception of Jesus himself. And as they reject the messengers of Jesus, so they are rejecting the person of Jesus himself. And so the basis of judgment is the same as it always is, their attitude to Jesus. So here is not a plea for people to be humanitarian to all in need. Here is a passage about people's attitude to the messengers of the gospel of Jesus. That's what it's about, which puts it still on the basis of judgment. And again, it is making the general theme of one that the judgment comes and mankind is divided. Well now, they are the simple ones. Let us turn to the difficult one. Verse 29. Of chapter 24 it is. Immediately after the distress, the Son of Man comes. Now, when does the Son of Man come? What is the distress of verses 15 to 28? What is the coming of the Son of Man in verses 29 to 31? There are three alternatives I give you this evening that are listed there. The first is to take verse 29 to refer to the end of the world. The second is to take verse 29 as referring to the destruction of the temple. The third is to take verse 29 as referring, verse 29, 30 rather, as referring to the resurrection and ascension of Jesus Christ. There are the three alternatives. Roughly 90% of the world believes number one, or 95% of those who read the scriptures, and about 4 or 5% would believe in the second alternative, and I've only ever met one person who believes the third alternative. Now, they're all theologically true. The question is, what did Jesus mean, and what did Matthew record? The traditional answer, you see, sees the return of Jesus in being described in verses, the return of Jesus in verses 29 to 31, that is the second coming, the end of the world, the judgment time, when the sun will be literally darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars fall from the sky, etc. That being so, verses 15 to 28 is considered to equal the destruction of the temple, which is the precursor for the end of the world, the pointer for the end of the world. Now, there are problems with it. Otherwise, I wouldn't raise the whole issue. That is the normal way of understanding the passage, but there are real problems. Verses 32 to 35 say it's going to happen in that generation. Now, that is a problem, isn't it? Some say that proves that Jesus was wrong. I don't follow that line. I think you can answer it. The answer comes along this way, by taking the phrase "these things" to refer to verses 15 to 28 and the destruction of the temple, and the word "it" to refer to Jesus coming. And so verse 33-34 would read, "Even so, when you see all these things, the destruction of the temple, the great distress, you know that he is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things about the temple have happened." See, you can make sense of that passage in a way that is true of apocalyptic literature, getting all the things junked up together and yet making particular point. However, it is an unusual and unnatural way of reading verses 33 and 34. And so it is a problem. But there are lots of other problems with the traditional interpretation. Why is the return of the Lord dependent upon the destruction of the temple? Does that mean Jesus couldn't have returned before the temple was destroyed? Because the rest of the New Testament is written before the temple is destroyed, and they always think he's going to come any tick of the clock. Why is it literal? Why do you take verse 29, the sun darkened, etc., literally, when every other reference in the Bible, it's figurative and symbolic? Why does the Son of Man come down? You see, this interprets the Son of Man coming on the clouds as coming back down to us, when the Daniel 7 picture is the Son of Man coming in the clouds to God. That is, he's going up. It's heading the opposite direction. We discussed it a couple of weeks ago when Archie came over here. You've got to come each week to understand these allusions. Verse 30 then also is a problem. Why are the nations, or why is the nation Israel, mourning at that time at the return of Jesus? And why is the sign of the Son of Man coming? It's not just the Son of Man comes. Verse 30 says, the sign will appear. Why does the sign of the Son of Man appear at the return of the Lord? I wouldn't have thought you needed a sign then. You would see him. It's a strange phrase, but you see, it just doesn't take account of some of the phrases that are there. So the second alternative was proposed some few years ago in a journal article, the Reformed Theological Review, about 5 years ago now, 6 years ago. That is to take verses 29 to 31 to refer to the temple. Not to the end of the world, but the destruction of the temple. The Son of Man starts his judgment with the destruction of the temple. That's what the Old Testament will say anyway. And so the return of the Lord then is not being discussed until verse 36. That day, that hour. Now there's much to commend this interpretation. It certainly overcomes the problem of the first interpretation. It certainly, for example, in verses 32 to 35, did happen in that generation. The temple was destroyed in that generation. There are some problems to it, like why in verse 31 do you see angels coming, gathering in the... Who are the angels? Well, remember, the word angel just means messenger. It's the everyday Greek word for messenger. And sometimes they're human messengers. They don't have to be supernatural beings. And so the angels gathering in the elect are the evangelists sent out to preach the gospel. In verse 29 says, immediately after the distress. Oh, sorry, let me go back to that evangelism one. The evangelism of the world, of course, took place after the temple was destroyed. Up till the time the temple was destroyed, Israel continued to be a nation, but in 70 AD, the temple was destroyed and Israel no longer was of any significance. And so that was the great time when the church became Gentile. And so the destruction of the temple and then the sending out of the angels, sending out of the messengers to gather in the elect from all the nations. Verse 29 talks about immediately after the distress. So what is the distress? What is verses 15 to 28? On this principle, journal article will tell you that verses 15 to 28 refers to the campaign prior to the destruction of the temple. That is, the temple was destroyed in AD 70 after a four-year campaign. The warfare started in AD 66, and most of that time the temple in Jerusalem was under siege, and there were particularly dreadful scenes of destruction within the city of Jerusalem. And so this passage here about the dreadful times and pray that it doesn't happen in winter and all that is referring to the siege that took place before the destruction of the temple in verse 29. Well then, for some years I thought that was a good way of taking the passage, but I found problems with it consistently. One, why do we refer to the sign of the Son of Man coming? If it's the destruction of the temple, how is that the sign of the Son of Man coming? Secondly, why is the nation mourning about the pierced one rather than about the temple? Thirdly, why quote Zechariah? Because the Zechariah passage, the one thing that's left standing is the temple. And here it's being quoted of the time when the temple will be destroyed. Seems a strange passage to be quoting now. And why date the Gentile mission from the time of the destruction of the temple? After all, Paul has said that he's preached the gospel to everybody. And he said that before the temple was destroyed. In fact, Paul was dead before the temple was destroyed. Why not see the Gentile mission starting with Paul or the conversion of Cornelius? And verse 15, what is the abomination that desolates standing in the holy place? If that's the beginning of the four-year campaign, that seems most peculiar. You would have thought that was the end of the campaign when the Romans took over the temple. There was no abomination that desolates it at the beginning of the campaign. So then there is a third alternative. That is verses 29 to 31. refers to the resurrection and ascension, the exaltation of Jesus. That is, the Son of Man now is going up, as he should be, according to Daniel 7, on this line. And it has great strengths to it, and problems, of course. The strengths are like these. After the exaltation, he will send the messengers to the world to gather the elect from the corners of the world. That is, the worldwide evangelism is to take place after the exaltation of Jesus. Well, that is exactly right. That's what Matthew will tell you in chapter 28. He sends them into the world. And it's also what happens the day of Pentecost, that they're sent into the world. Verses 32 to 35, it happened in this generation. It's certainly the exaltation, the ascension, resurrection happened in the generation. So again, verses 32 to 35 would fit in this passage. The sign of the Son of Man now makes sense, because the sign of the Son of Man coming in power and glory is the resurrection. That is the great sign that Jesus is the Son of Man and that the kingdom of God has arrived. That would then make sense. And the morning would now make sense, because it was on the day of Pentecost, when Peter preached of the exaltation of Jesus, that the people of Israel, from all the tribes of Israel, gathered in Jerusalem on the great feast, were cut to the heart that they had crucified the Messiah and asked, what must we do to be saved? And so there is a great national mourning for the one whom they had pierced on the day of Pentecost. Well, what is the problem with that interpretation? The problem lies in the fact that all this happens immediately after the distress. And so what now is verse 15 to 28 referring to? What is the distress? On this line, the distress must be the crucifixion. That is what verses 15 to 28 is referring to. Could it possibly be? Well, yes, at certain points, and no, it has problems. Yes, because that is the abomination that causes desolation. In Daniel 9, it is linked to the striking of the Anointed One. That is one of the most abominable things that could happen, and the overthrow of the temple by pagans happened many times. Caligula, Pompey, Antiochus Epiphanes, even the Samaritans. There were all kinds of times in which sacrilege was done in the temple. If it's just referring to sacrilege in the temple, then people would be fleeing frequently. But if it's referring to the death of Jesus, then that could make sense. That is a time to flee. And we also know that the New Testament says, strike the shepherd and the sheep will flee. And Jesus encourages them to. Furthermore, you're told in verse 21, that this great distress is unequalled from the beginning of the world until now and has never been equalled again. What is the most dreadful thing that has ever happened or could ever happen? The destruction of Jerusalem doesn't really fit into that category. The destruction by the Babylonians was every bit as bad, if not worse. Why say the Roman destruction was the greatest one? But the killing of the Prince of Life, the Son of God, the glorious Messiah, was there ever anything as bad as that? Well, it could be the death of Jesus that's being referred to, but the phrase about, look, here is the Christ, there he is, etc., we know nothing of that happening. Doesn't say that we have to, but we know nothing of it. Certainly in the context of Jesus' last teaching to his disciples, it would make sense that he is warning them about the terrible thing that is about to take place and on which they could easily get caught up in, only it's going to happen very quickly so as to spare them. Therefore, I hold to the third of those three views and encourage you to the first. For why should you be one of the minority in the world? All three are theologically true. All of them make sense theologically. It really is a question of what is that being referred to here? And do you perceive the problem that once you take verse 29 to refer to one thing, then all the other things in the chapter now have to refer to different things? If you take it referring to a second thing, then again they're going to refer to other things. And so, above all, I'd be wary of people who are too confident as to what it refers to. Herbert W. Armstrong in particular. Now then, What is clear? Here we come up the home straight. Do wake up. Those who have had the trouble now for the last little while, because there were too many possibilities and too many ins and outs and you really weren't interested anyway. Now wake up, because now we tell you what the whole thing's about. And that matters. You ready? Three things. One, beware of deceivers, ancient or modern. They will always be around, people who are seeking to deceive, and their deceptions keep on looking for the signs of the times and say, this is the day, that's the day, it's going to be then. I was told back in 1969 that the end of the world had to be by 1973 because of the 10 nations getting together in the European Common Market. It's all there, Gog, Magog, the rest of it, all coming together, you know? I was told a couple of years ago when Iran opened war with Iraq that it had to be X number of years after that because of this verse and that verse and all. As soon as someone says, going on like that, you know he's a twit and walk away from him. People going around saying, there is the Christ, there he is. In 1914, the Jehovah's Witnesses had predicted that Jesus would return. 1914 came, 1914 went, no Jesus turned up. A vast majority of Jehovah's Witnesses defected and gave it away. But the little minority said, he did come, invisibly. Next time they come to your door, ask them what 1914 means to them, and they will tell you that was the time when Jesus returned, invisibly. I would have thought that what this passage is saying is, don't believe it when people say, he was over there, he's over there, because when he appears, no one will be in any doubt about the matter. Beware of the deceivers, ancient or modern, who pinpoint this thing and that thing as fulfilling prophecy and opening up for us the new age. Beware of them. Secondly, persevere. Especially that passage, verses 4 to 14, but also the parables. Persevere in the gospel of Jesus Christ, in its proclamation and in your belief in it and your obedience to it. Even though times may be difficult and hard, persevere. Do not fall prey to the growing cold because of the wickedness of the world. Do not be overcome or feel that you are being overcome by the powers of evil that range against gospel preaching. Persevere. Keep going. For the day will come when all will be made clear, and you will also. Thirdly, the passage is about judgment. The judgment, I think, starts with evangelism because it starts with the reception of the gospel message. As the angels go out and preach the gospel, so people respond negatively and positively. The gospel divides mankind. And as mankind is divided through gospel preaching, so the day of judgment will show that division. When it comes, we do not know. Not even the Son knows that day or that hour. But that it is coming, Jesus is making perfectly clear. And when it comes, on that day, you will be found out. And you'll be found out in relationship to your attitude to Jesus. It could be today. It is, in terms of the preaching of the gospel. For I am telling you now that as you receive Jesus or reject him, so stands your eternity. See, the judgment comes in that very message, doesn't it? It's come to you now. What do you do with it? Reject Jesus? For if he were to appear now, he would reject you. Accept Jesus? If he were to come now, he would be accepting you. What happens on that last day is just the outworking of what you are doing this day and every day. I recognise that that whole section now has opened up 1,000 questions, and I also recognise that it's too late to start dealing with them publicly. I'm sorry about that. They're just a long passage to deal with in one hit, isn't it? However, I promise to stand for a little while after the evening, formal part of our meeting is finished, and to try and handle whatever curly questions you wish to throw to me on that passage. We're going to sing a hymn, are we?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.